Mum.
Morning.
What a way to spend the afternoon.
Morning.
Afternoon, morning, whatever. What a way. Anyway, as you can see, I'm trying to sort out the logistics of this morning's session. Unfortunately, not all our speakers can make it to the session, which is really unfortunate. I've just received a text from Diane Abbott to say, unfortunately, she's not able to attend. Equally, Amina is not able to attend. Counselling Amina Ibrahim is not able to attend. This might actually be a commentary on the theme of the session, actually. Black women trying to transform or attempt to transform politics. Now, when the session was actually organised some months ago, or the idea and the speakers were formally invited, we knew nothing of the conference programme. In fact, it wasn't until a week ago that I was formally told that I was a delegate to the conference. So really, I should be here. I should be in the conference debating and voting. But I think this is a commentary on some of the struggles, some of the barriers, some of the ways in which black women have to improvise situations, particularly when they're determined by others. However, that aside, we have three excellent women speakers this morning who will share their remarkable phenomenal journey in terms of being on the political stage, or more generally being active within their local communities trying to make a difference. So I hope you will find the session inspiring, engaging, and certainly after I've heard the presentations, I'm hoping you will then participate. What I've done, I asked all our speakers to spend 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. I sent an email out to all our speakers asking them to spend 5 to 10 minutes basically mapping for us their journey, but more significantly, tangible things that they think can be done to give women, but black ethnic minority women, a more powerful, significant, and influential voice on the public stage, and in particular within the political arena. So, please allow me to do something that I do as part of my bread and butter, and that is to read a lot. Now, as light reading, or for light reading, I took on holiday recently a book written by Mary Beard, Women and Power, a manifesto. Now, many of you in the audience will be aware of Mary Beard, a professor at the University of Oxford, not Cambridge, Oxford, who is a remarkable classicist. In fact, it's just a pity she, Diane Abbott's not here, because I think, yes, it is Oxford, because Diane went to Oxford, because both were at university at the same time. So I took this on holiday with her. Now, Mary Beard, in this manifesto of hers, covers two main themes in relation to women and power, a manifesto. She focuses on the public voice of women, and then she looks at women in power. So women trying to obtain a voice, to demonstrate a voice, have a voice. given that voice, how they utilise that voice. And I will just quote a few sentences on the first theme, the public voice of women, because I will leave the action, the activism, to our esteemed panellists. She starts off by saying, "I want to start very near the beginning of the tradition of Western literature and its first recorded example of a man telling a woman to shut up, telling her that her voice was not to be heard in public." End of quote. Now, there have been, the last 2 weeks, typical examples of telling women to shut up and not to raise their voices in the public arena. Common occurrence, but I will quote one that hopefully everyone will recall. The situation of Serena Williams. A black woman who dares to contest publicly what she considered her perception of an injustice done to her and calling it out. So what she did, she used her voice and called out the injustice she was subjected to. And many commentary on this, including a brilliant article by Gary Young in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago, 13th of September, the Serena cartoon debate, calling out racism, not censorship. So one of the ways in which Serena was persecuted, chastised, or dared to use her voice, was to be subjected to grotesque, racist caricature of her as a black woman. And we can conjure up all sorts of narrative. The mammy, the Medusa. Grotesque. So here is an example, as I said, of a woman, a black woman in particular, dare to raise her voice. I've also asked for the distribution of an article that I wrote a year ago about another prominent woman, but in this respect she should have been here on the stage, Dyne Abbott. A prominent black MP who dares to raise her voice and the persecution that she has been subjected to. So, without further ado, I will begin by asking our esteemed panellists to share with us their journey of being in the public stage, whether in politics, as activists, and after that, some pointers, some concrete example, ways forward for how we, black women in particular, because this is about black women, can be empowered and supported in taking their rightful place on the public stage, in politics in particular, to transform politics. So I will start with our first esteemed speaker, Zita Holborn. Please say a little bit about yourself, Zita.
Good morning, greetings everyone. So my name is Zita. I'm a human rights campaigner, community activist, a trade union activist, and a Labour Party activist. I'm the National Vice President of the Public and Commercial Services Union, and I'm also the Joint National Chair of Artists Union England. So in addition to being an activist, I'm a visual artist, a curator, a poet, an author, and a writer, and a vocalist. I'm very much involved in the arts. So I try and use the arts to campaign about the things that I'm passionate about. So I'm not just doing, you know, speaking at things and performing at things and writing about things that matter to me, and try and challenge things in different ways through creativity as well as through politics. So for me, the two things are intertwined. I became active really as a child. For me, there wasn't a choice. It wasn't that I chose to be an activist, or I chose to be a campaigner, or I chose to be political. Actually, growing up, having to contend with sexism, misogyny, racism, as a young black child, a child of mixed parentage, actually meant that I had no choice but to tackle head-on the things that I was facing. I also grew up with parents that were part of the boycott campaign and the anti-apartheid movement. So I think that gave me a good grounding in terms of how you can mobilise people, how you can build a global movement, and how people can come together to campaign on a human rights issue and against fascism and apartheid. So I think it was quite a positive grounding that I grew up in that environment. My parents were also Labour Party members, so actually joining the Labour Party as a teenager wasn't a choice. It was something that was told people, now join, you know, we'll be active in the Labour Party. So I just kind of got on with it and did it. And I think that, you know, some people will look at the positions I hold and think, okay, so you hold quite senior positions in the trade union movement. You know, I'm called a trade union leader. But actually, it's quite a long journey to be in the position I'm in. And you have to go through quite a lot of battles and struggles, because there's this expectation of you as a woman, as a black person, so if you are both, there's this double expectation that you should be twice as good or work twice as hard as your white counterpart. That's something actually that was drilled into a lot of us as children, that if we wanted to get on here, that's what we're going to have to do. Actually, I don't agree with that. You know, it's something that is sort of forced upon you, that concept. But I don't see why, as a black woman, I can't make mistakes, I can't learn from my mistakes, I can't try things, fail, try again, try something new, and why I have to be, you know, like some superhero person. And that is sometimes how we're portrayed. You know, we're either facing racism and misogyny, or we're considered to be some strong super person. And actually, if we cry about something, or we complain about something, or we say that something harms us or hurts us, the response is, oh, but you're a strong black woman. How can you have feelings? It's like, we're not robots, we're human beings, but there is this perception that we're superhuman, which is a nonsense. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a human being. I bleed like everybody else. You know, I feel sorrow and I feel anger like everybody else. But as Cecile's already set out, a lot of the time, when we express our anger, if a white man expressed that same anger, they would be told, you know, well, that's good, they're very assertive, very positive person, they're standing up for their rights. As soon as it's a black woman that does it, we're told that, you know, we're aggressive, we're loud, we're negative, we're making a fuss about nothing, you know, we're a scary person. And I think that we all have a responsibility to challenge that. So I think that, you know, I started as a grassroots activist in the trade union movement, and I became a trade union rep because I challenged some things that the union was doing and threatened to leave. So in threatening to leave the union because they hadn't dealt with something I wanted them to deal with, which is not the union I'm in now, it's a previous union, My annoyance at how things have been dealt with led to me being encouraged to be a rep. So that I was told to come along to a meeting, and I left that meeting as the branch equality officer and the branch chair. So I went in not a rep at all, and it kind of just continued from there. And I think because I'm vocal and I speak out on things, you know, I moved through different positions. I probably held every position under the sun, treasurer, trade union side, secretary, you know, all sorts of different positions, health and safety reps. I've done it all. But what I realised as a trade union rep, and the same happens with the Labour Party or any sphere of politics, is that you are often stereotyped into the equality role. Yeah? So they expect you to be the equality rep or the black rep or the women's rep. And there's even, as a black woman, you're not expected to participate in anything to do with your gender. Because you're black, you can do the black things over there. You don't need to go to the gender thing. So you're competing, actually, a lot of the time with white women. And so there is this thing that, okay, well, there's 100 white women and maybe there's 3 black women in that grouping. Oh, but you can go to the black thing. So you don't need to go to the women's thing. Let one of the other women go. So it's like you're supposed to, like, just completely ignore the fact that you have a gender as well, that you are a woman, that you are facing sexism and misogyny, that actually you have something important to say and do for gender equality. And that's wrong, and that has to be challenged. So you're often challenging things as you go along. And if you're not one of those people that feel comfortable challenging, it can mean that you're sidelined as a black woman, that you're swept aside and you don't get the opportunities. So effectively, you kind of have to fight for those opportunities. But what I also think is that you have to build alliances. So from my perspective, I'm all about bringing up people behind me. If I vacate a position, I want to bring another black person, another black woman into that position and encourage people, because I think we need to leave a legacy for the next generation, that we need to support people. And because there's so few of us in various positions, sometimes people want to compete against each other, and I'm not about that. I don't agree with that. I think we need to have a collective perspective on things and bring other black women up with us and support them. But I also think sometimes some white men and actually some white women need to step aside. So I do agree with positive action. Some people think that positive action is positive discrimination or the American model of affirmative action. But we have to remember, actually, it's allowed in law. It's, positive action is part of equality legislation. It's part of equality legislation that the Labour Party fought for and introduced. So if we have to use positive action to give black women a level playing field in politics, I think it's important to do that. But what I found that I didn't want to be limited as a campaigner and an activist to what I could do in the trade union movement. I felt there's so many issues impacting on us as black women, as black people globally. So I campaign on climate change, on human rights issues. And in 2010, I co-founded Black Activists Rising Against Cuts, which is a national campaigning organisation against the adverse disproportionate impact on black workers, service users and communities, but also against the rising and deepening racism and injustice that black communities are facing because of austerity and because of negative racist policies by the Tories. And running that organisation is my own organisation, and the national chair means that I can ensure that we always give black women a platform. So sometimes we will have an entire platform which is black women, and we work by the motto of nothing about us, without us. So that, you know, it's all very well people saying they're going to talk about these issues but not include us. That's out of order. How can you be, you know, not you individuals, but in general, people setting up structures or organising events to talk about how these things are impacting on us, but we're not on the platform and we don't have a voice? So I think it's important when you're organising events and you're organising in your communities or your CLP or your ward, that you ensure the voices of the people you're you're talking about are included, and that we should lead our struggles. We need white allies, you know, we need male allies, we need people to back us and support us and come out with us, but actually you can't be leading our struggles because you haven't walked in our shoes. So it's really important. And there is this tendency across politics for white men to take over. That's the reality. And want to run things and control things. You know, when it comes to delegates going to Labour Party conference or going to your trade union conference or going to the TC Congress, you know, it's predominantly white men that are holding those positions. Sometimes you just need to step aside, go as an observer, take a year out, let somebody else go and have an opportunity. It's just out of order. And I think that we need to call it out when that's not happening. And sometimes if you're the black woman in that branch or that board or that CLP, it's not that easy for you to argue and fight that by yourself, because then you're branded and labelled as, oh, this like bolshy person that's throwing their weight around or throwing a hissy fit, like what happened with Serena, and you think you're better than everybody else because you want to go along. No, you want to go along because you want to make a difference and have a voice, and you shouldn't have to battle and fight for the right to go along. But that's how we're labelled. So actually, it's important that everybody else speaks out about that, and that you have, you equality proof everything you do. So whatever you're involved in terms of politics, equality proof it. Ask the question, why are you doing it this way? Who are you including? Who is this about? Who are you speaking for? Where are their voices in that discussion that you're having? Because if you don't check yourself, yeah, then nothing's ever going to change. So we have a collective responsibility, but we have an individual responsibility. And I think, you know, we have this anti-fascist movement. 4 minutes?
Okay.
We have like an anti-fascist movement, and lots of people say, I'm an anti-racist, I'm an anti-fascist, I'm going to go out and stand up against the far right and counter-protest when there's the far right. And yes, that's important. We've got the rise of fascism across Europe. We do need to stand up to that. But those same people are not saying, when they hear something racist, microaggressions, snide comments, the nasty things that go on Twitter, and I myself know firsthand what it's like Diane Abbott's experience, to be stalked both online and physically, you know, and have death threats and misogyny and racism thrown at me. So I know what that feels like, and people need to call it out. It can't just be for the people that are on the receiving end to call that out. So it's not good enough for people to say they're anti-racist or anti-sexist. You need to be for race equality and for gender equality. And that means you need to put, you know, your words into action. So what you say you are, you need to do something about it. Waving a flag at an anti-fascist rally is one thing, yeah? But actually calling out the racism and the systemic institutional racism and sexism that exists in every aspect of our lives and society, whether it's in your workplace, your university, your CLP, yeah? Hopefully it doesn't exist there. But if it does, you need to call it out. If there are people that don't understand gender or race equality that you're working with, that needs to be explained to them. And if it means you need to bring people in to do talks like this, then do it, because sometimes, you know, you just have to tell it as it is. And one of the things Barrack has always done is when we see, for example, Diane, and I keep putting there like Diane should be Diane Abbott under attack, we will put out a statement from Barrack UK. And we will say, you know, we completely oppose what's happened to her. It's outrageous. We stand by her. But we give practical solidarity as well when we see people under threat and attack. So symbolic solidarity is very nice. It's wonderful to get messages and for people to sign statements, and it's good and important. I do quite a lot of that myself. But actually, practical solidarity is really, really important. When you're under threat and you're under attack, just having somebody to come out and physically be there and physically do something makes a huge difference. And I think I'm out of time here, so I'm going to stop.
Thank you so much. But in addition to all the things that are listed about Young Mashing, I'm also the Vice Chair of the Momentum National Coordinating Committee. Thank you. And now, next speaker, Councillor Anna Rothery.
Is it okay for me to stand? Because I'm not very good at talking, sitting down, is that okay? Good morning, comrades. It's nice to have such a great turnout today. As Cecile's just said, I'm a local councillor here in Princess Park Ward, which is just up the road. I'm also the Bureau Lead for Equality and Race Equality for the city. And I've been a councillor for 13 years, which seems to be just a heartbeat away, really. But can I just take you back to the motivation why I became involved in politics? About 20 years ago, I had a chance meeting with a guy called Rufo Rivette. What a wonderful name for a man. And Rufo Rivette was one of Bill Clinton's advisors at the time. And he'd come to Liverpool, he'd come to the UK from the US on a visit. And he came out of his way. He wanted to come to Liverpool because he'd heard about the oldest black community in Europe. So he came to Liverpool in search of the black community. And the conversation I had with him started off with, where's all the black people? And I went, we're here. We're not visible. We all live in a place called Toxton. So I said, come with me and I'll take you round and I'll introduce you to our community. So I took him into Toxton. I was working on, I worked in the not-for-profit sector before I went into politics, so I was working in community organisations and I took him around. So he said to me, Anna, where's all the black politicians? I said, no, we haven't got no black politicians. And he couldn't believe it, he couldn't get his head round that we should have such a strong black community in this city, and we had not one black councillor in the council at that time. So he asked me, would I set up a scheme working with black women to look at black women going into public life and black women into politics. So that's basically what I did. I set up a scheme with his encouragement and support. We had 12 local women on the course, and I tell you, talk about difficult trying to get people onto it. It was absolutely horrendous. But you have to look at it in context. So back at that time, we had a community that was demonised and criminalised through stop and search. We had a community that had no employment. We were coming through from the riots in the 1980s in Toxteth. We had everything that could be stacked against a community was stacked against our community. So to say to a black woman, do you want to go into a program where you go into politics? Like, I don't think so. You know, it's like open season on black people at the moment. I'm not putting my head up against above the parapet. What we did, we encouraged women to come along, and they did the course. And in the meantime, I was raising the profile about the course, speaking to all parties at that time, because it was like, you know, get anybody into any party, let's do this. If we're going to do it, let's do it. Obviously, I wanted it to be the Labour Party, but it didn't stop the Labour Party. So I was out having conversations. I was speaking to Harriet Harman, who was running the Women in Public Life, and various people. So when we came to the end of the programme, and we were asking the women to go forward, to be shortlisted, even just to go through the process, the excuses started coming out fast and furious. So basically what happened was, we'd had a councillor for years. For people who don't know, we had a number of councillors in Liverpool. One at a time, I might add. Never more than one black councillor in Liverpool. So we had Patrona Lashley, and she was, you know, she was in there, she was doing her stuff. She was suffering incredible discrimination. She was trying to function in an all-white structure that was just not open to black women. And then we had another woman called Liz Drysdale, who was also in politics, and you couldn't meet a stronger woman. I could see some people smiling at the back. You know, you just don't mess around with Liz. Well, even Liz couldn't take it, you know, the discrimination, you know, just the way she was treated, you know, the sexism, the, you know, everything that was thrown at her. It was a really, really difficult period in time for black women to go into politics. So at the end of the day, these women said, no, we're not doing it. You know, my brother was arrested during the riots. This brother, this has happened. You know, if we go into politics, the first thing they're going to do is try and demonise us in the press. And that's what was happening at the time. If you were lucky to get into politics as a black woman at the time, you had to run a gauntlet. So you had the mayor against you, you had the press against you, you even had your own community against you, if I'm completely honest, because people were saying, what do you want to do that for? They don't do nothing for us. So it was a really difficult time. So I fully understood when the women said, we don't want to do it. So somebody approached me and said, right, you know, you'd ask, could we do this? Who's coming forward? And nobody was coming forward. So I basically, this is how naive I was. I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll just do it as a holder. I'll do, you know, I'll go forward. I probably won't get elected. If I do get elected, I'll stand for one term and I'll change the world overnight, completely transform politics, Liverpool, for black women. And I was really naive. But the starting point was, because I've been integral in the training course, I thought, if I go forward, I've got four black brothers. You know, all grew up in Toxteth. They're all being criminalised, demonised, well, yeah. And I thought, they're going to come for me. The first thing they're going to do when I stand is they're going to come for me. So I spoke to a guy called Ian Heenan, the werewolf of Westminster, is his pet name. And he was the political journal of Westminster. So I said, look, Ian, all our women fell away. They just don't want to open themselves up. I've ridiculously said, I'll stand. What do we do? So he said, aye. He said, you write a story. He said, you do a story, you give it, send it up to me, he said, I'll proofread it and I'll get put in the Echo, and you lay out exactly why you're standing. So that's exactly what I did. I did a two-page thread. I spoke about being a young socialist, I spoke about brothers who've been criminalised, I spoke about the severe racism in Liverpool, the Toxteth riots, the oppression, everything. I put it out there, I just thought, if you're going to come for me, there you go, it's all there. And it was the best thing that I did, because the press have been very, very friendly to me over the years. And they've actually gotten out of some scrapes. We'd have had, you know, arguments with people in the city. We'd have challenged the racism in the city. You know, they have come out of my defence, to say, even to say the least. 13 years later, I'm still here. For the first 6 years that I was elected, I was the only black councillor in the city. The only black councillor in the city. I was in 95 councillors. It was only me. And I'll tell you what, it was probably one of the difficult, most difficult things I've done in my life. But then I quickly worked with Operation Black Vote. We all have probably worked with Operation Black Vote at some point or another to set up a mentorship scheme for women in politics here in Liverpool. And, one of our colleagues has just walked in, Manda. Hi, Manda. Manda is a counsellor in Coventry. And she's one of our success stories. But, you know, this is the importance of having this sisterhood in terms of politics, that black sisters all stand together and we all support each other, because it's difficult. You know, people might look and go, oh, you've arrived, you've achieved this, you've achieved that. It's a constant struggle. So now, looking at the transformational changes taking place with Jen as our leader, you know we've had the democracy review. We know we're having the conversations, the real conversations on the ground. So we're talking about what are we going to do going forward. And as Issa has said, yeah, white men need to stand aside, take some time out, give us a bit of time to take control. But more importantly, we need to make sure that our young people coming up behind us. You know, I'm ready to retire in the next couple of years. But, you know, I can't go. And I always said, as soon as I've done my job, I'll be gone. 15 years later, I still can't go. You know, I do actually want a life. I have a life for a long time. I do want to spend time with my husband and my children. But, you know, we really have to encourage our young women to come forward. And, you know, I come forward now while we're here. You know, when I went into politics, nobody told me anything at all. You know, knowledge is power. Nobody shared any information with me. I was walking around the town hall, I was walking around the town, the council premises, just trying to find meetings. I didn't know where I was going, what I was doing. But I quickly, you know, learned how to function within that structure. But what we need now is for our young black women to hit the ground running. We need people who can tell them the do's and don'ts, the go-to people, which officers get things done for you. All the stuff that you can't read about, all the stuff that you learn while you're on the ground. So we need to ensure that we do that. 4 minutes. Gosh, I was ready to finish.
She just said
that. She just interrupted my big ending for me. But no, I mean, I think that Zita touched on in terms of the anti-fascist group. I do a lot of work with the Rights Against Fascism, and I do a lot of work around equality nationally. And that's right, the point that was made there. Because we always focus on the Tommy Robinsons. You know, we focus on this person and that person. But, you know, we've got people walking amongst us. We've got, you know, don't think that, you know, we don't have racists and fascists, you know, walking around with us. You know, because we do. And, you know, I always say, give me a fascist anytime, because I know who they are. You can see them who they are. You know where they are, and you know what they're doing. It's the other people that worry me, the people who are part of the structures, people who are part of that political structure, and you can't see who they are. They're not automatically known to you. But you can judge people by their actions. Somebody once said to me, if somebody shows you who they are, then believe them. You know, so, and I've encountered situations like that where people have systematically, periodically, show me who they are and where they stand in terms of equality. And I believe them. So I'm going to finish probably one at a time, and I'm going to say, it's great to be here, and it's great to see all the people turning up at the different events. And let's take control of this government and put things right. Thank you.
I was raised to believe I could do whatever I wanted to do.
I could be the lowest of persons or the highest of persons. And I think that held me good stead my whole life, has held me good stead my whole life. I don't necessarily see the barriers, or in my formative years, those barriers were not made apparent to me. I came back to this country with all of that under my belt and to go to university, and I remember one of my most enduring experiences at university was I was discussing this with some friends last night, and we laughed about it, and I said, we'll talk about this today. And I remember being, it was a small university, a very good university, but a small one in the north. And so I was there on my course, political science, as the only student of any colour amongst my white peers. And I remember one of my peers wanted to buy some marijuana. Not me. She did. She was from Kent. And she said, oh, Sonia will know where to get some. And I almost jumped out of my skin because I thought, me, why would I know? But that resonates so much with me because I was situated, because of the colour of my skin and my background, she had formed all sorts of opinions about what I would know and what I would do and that I would know where to find marijuana. And whatever I may admit subsequently, I had never smoked marijuana at all. And I was just really shocked, but I remember it, and it was really part of that formative process. Other things have happened, of course, in terms of me expressing, you know, I'm going to get a first class degree, and being told, encouraged by some of my professors, that's possible, you know, work hard, but other people say, no, that's impossible. I think on the course at the time when I did it, nobody had had a first class degree in that subject for 10 years, a decade, and here I was professing that was my aim. And guess what? I achieved it. I'm very proud of that. So I then go and get my first job, go through my education, and go for my first job, University of Derby. I'd done some part-time teaching in there at the University of Derby, was my first full-time job. And I was asked by somebody, did you interview for your post? I'm just thinking, well, how else would you get a job into university? Again, it's the assumptions. I think this speaks to the issue of how, and as E.T. said earlier about affirmative action, that somebody thought that I just got it with no qualifications, no experience, and just decided, we need a black one, you'll be it. And I was just aghast again at, you know, these perceptions that people held. There I am, 17 years working in the academic field, and so many incidents, too much to tell as to how I got to where I am. But I also kept a hand in my community, doing various, you know, working for the Women's Centre, and a refuge, and a centre that befriended families who were going through chaotic times, and all sorts of volunteering. So I also, as well as my academic side, kept my hand in practical community, grassroots level delivery of services and so on. So I knew the community quite well. So in 2009, I've been teaching for 17 years, I've risen up the ranks a little bit, but I was increasingly disillusioned by many things. And one of those things was my specialist subject was human rights. And year after year, cohorts of students come in and we sort of take you through the ropes of human rights and why they're so important, etc., etc. And year after year, through different cohorts of students, you get requests, you get people saying, things like, there are too many human rights in this country, we need to take them from this group or that group or the other group. And I came to feel somewhat disillusioned that I wasn't making the impact I thought I would make as an educator, that somehow I was failing and I needed to shift gear, do something different. And so I decided in 2009 that I do exactly that. And what was 2000? There's something about economic crises in my life, I can tell you. 2008 was the economic crisis. And so in 2009, I decided to set up to leave my well-paid job and to moved to a sector that I had some kind of pretensions about, a utopian sector where everybody was working in solidarity, that they understood the issues of diversity and equality. And there I was, I'm leaving academia, and I'm going here, I'm leaving the ivory tower, and I'm going into to work at the coalface. One of the first things I did was to work for my local, it's called Community Action, but it's a voluntary sector, it's what's known as a voluntary sector, Council for Voluntary Sector Services, a CVS, in most of the places. So I went to get some training, really. I volunteered for them for 2 years, because I thought, I know about the community, but I need to know more, and I need to have an authentic, to be authentic in my delivery of knowing that community. Even though I felt I knew it quite well. So I went in and I was delivering my services, and I remember I'd become advising voluntary sector organisations on policy, on financing, how to find funding, and all sorts of things, going out and looking at buildings, etc. Quite experienced in the post. And I remember this one day, that somebody came in and she had an appointment, she thought she had an appointment with the person who was my boss. She came in, and interestingly, she worked for an organisation that welcomed refugees into the city where I'm from. So here she was, she came in and she balked when she saw me. She really balked, and she absolutely refused to take the meeting with me. And although there's some speculation as to why this was, she just kept saying, I have an appointment to see Liz, not you. Liz, not you. And I then went, I was tearful. I'm quite, you know, I'm strong.
It's a strong black woman.
But she managed with her behaviour and her simple refusal. There was something about me that she felt I would be competent to advise her on any issue, and yet she was advocating for refugees. And this is often the conundrum that you find at the grassroots level. There are so many things about us without us, so many things. And people feel that they are legitimate in the positions that they take when they act and behave in these ways. And I went to my boss and I said, she's refusing for me to advise her about her group, her policies, her funding, etc. So can you calm down? And she was livid because she totally got what was going on. And she said, Sonia is the advisor, that's what she does every day. And I said, Liz, I'm not now willing to take the meeting, actually. And I walked away. I'm not now willing. And she came to, and so she took the meeting with Liz, and afterwards, she came and apologised. She tried to apologise, and she became tearful. That's another thing that happens quite a lot. And it takes away your legitimacy. It takes away you have a right in this situation. You're wrong, and that happens considerably. It's how people retrieve ground and also gain allies. Because if this big black woman is making you cry, then somehow I feel I should be apologising. Oh, I'm really sorry that I made you cry, even though you completely came in with an agenda that said, you're not competent to advise me. And again, that's something that happens quite a lot in the grassroots. In any case, that event passed, I was seething, and it continues to be a cause of much emotion for me. Because you think, in this sector, people are amazing. Diversity, equality, this is a common language here, but it isn't necessarily the case. To say something about the city that I work in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, there was a really good infrastructure. There was really good infrastructure in terms of black organisation. That all disappeared. I think all of the black community is now really dispersed. And all people moved to London, like my siblings, they all moved to London because opportunities were better, etc., etc. So in my city where I live, you do not have a black population that you can necessarily call on or even find. You know, there is no black area that you could necessarily call on. So you are building constantly from, you know, you're constantly starting from nowhere in terms of delivering service and trying to build capacity, which is what I spend a lot of my time doing. In the organisation that I run, a lot of the work is trying to build capacity, trying to do some political education, because there is none. How do you build capacity? How do people recognise their agency where there is no education around that agency? We have an entire school system that ignores anything to do with voting. It's a massive democratic deficit, and nobody's doing anything. It's almost as if it's inbuilt, that's the status quo. That's the society we want to do. And we do things like voter registration drives, educating people about their rights to vote, of different people with different statuses, for example, and they are unaware of this. And talking to young people about their rights, and people in universities, by and large, are pretty much aware of their rights in terms of voting, but what about the others? And it's the others that we need to build the ranks and sustain the movement. And the others, very often, are not so much difficult to reach, but they don't think politics has anything to do with them. So how do we continue to create spaces where everybody's included? We spend far much time talking to ourselves and not growing to expand people who you really have to work hard to engage. And as I'm running out of time, I hope I'll get to say some more, but thank you for listening.
And what we also found is that being a black woman sometimes is really, it's also portrayed through a guise of like strife, of negativity, of you will be racially abused, or you will be dismissed, you will be had control of like being a million to be days to put your head above the parapet. And what we found is when me and my two friends who started the Goddess Project together, we just had a ball, which is the Scouse saying of a great time. So we had a lovely time, and we uplifted each other. And we thought that there needs to be a step before politics before activism, where we build with women on a ground level of just providing safe spaces where they feel that they can build their resilience and that they can uplift each other. So if you want to do stuff like, you know, research, you want to do stuff like sessions on hair, you want to do stuff for, you know, childminded, for single mothers, you want to do things that take them on walks to different places, which you would never really do. And we want to do loads of different things about literature and things like that. So we want to sort of build on that resilience so that when they do step into the public arena, they don't just have themselves and that resilience to deal with the day-to-day. They also have a tribe of women behind them who can support them, which has been picked up about this idea of being quite isolated in different areas. And so my question really is, what sort of advice would you give to us in our initial stages of setting up something like this? Because even though this is about politics, we think it's important for us to start with people, you know, where they are and build up that strong community and them strong bonds so that then when they uplift into public life, that they can. So what would your advice be for us?
Rather than a question. I don't remember names apart from Anna's, but can I just say grassroots is the most important level to be at. I'm grassroots, and that's where change is made from the bottom, not at the top. But if there are some good people at the top, they can legislate and bring about policy. So don't forget about anybody in this room. So many things I could touch on what you said, and I'll just give an example. We had our Save Liverpool Women's Hospital march yesterday because they're trying to close the women's hospital down. And my take on that is women bring every human being into the world, so at least give them one facility that's their own, that's not dominated by men, that is a safe space for women, and all the complexities that come about because of women's health, and we all know as women what they are. We know about our reproductive organs, and I don't care how many books you read, you can't tell me what pregnancy and stuff is if you're a man, with respect. Anna, that's my mantra. When a person shows themselves to you, believe it. And I had an example of that recently, because I attend the board meetings at the Women's Hospital. I'm the only BME person who attends, and there's one noticeable BME person on the board. And I say noticeable, and it's important, because I have nephews and nieces who look white, but they're part African, so I'm saying noticeable. And they gave a presentation about equality and diversity in the workforce, in the women's, and the demographic in this city is 12%. Representation in the women's is 6%, and I would have to interrogate that and find out if that's the very low-paid jobs, which we know they probably are. They said that in the senior manager and executive positions, it's non-existent. So I immediately saw that on the presentation. The only noticeable BME person on the board interrogated that. So when it came time for me to speak, I said, if you don't interrogate the narrative properly towards the BME and what's lacking, you perpetuate the problem and you make it appear as something else, because they were saying that in the BME community, 6% underrepresented, lots of bullying, but they didn't question racism or anything like that. And she ended with saying, but in the white community, in the workforce, which happens to be 94%, there is more bullying. Well, explode my brain, by default, I expect that. They viciously, verbally attacked me. They came in my space. They spoke at me. They spoke over me. They shouted and screamed at me. One woman shoved a phone under my nose and said, Teresa, you don't understand, because how would I understand about equality and diversity? And she shoved a phone under my face and said, if one BME person is bullied, but 18 white are, said, well, we don't have the statistics, the percentages, so that doesn't make any sense. So I'm waiting for the next board meeting when I go back, because change is going to come. So I just wanted to point out on what you've said, because we can all constantly just say, that happened to me, I experienced that. And can I say the next Prime Minister may be sitting in this room, So have confidence in yourself regardless of colour. And pauper's graves around the world are full of people whose aspiration, potential and genius was suppressed.
Thank you so much.
And so I'm very grateful for that.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your opinion about like the current interest in racism, like from the mainstream UK, right? Because Renny Elliott says that she lived for a living for a bit of a moment where there is more of an opportunity to talk about this, and like so. But she is like, and I love her, but she is a baby in the game compared to you, and so she might not be right. And I'm wondering, like, say, on 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning, like you have got like a mostly white crowd standing out to talk about like black women politics, like, and you know, do you think that would, is that sort of like historically interesting? Is there any kind of moment, and like how?
Sorry, are you asking about the demographics? Well, I think it's reflective of politics in this country, it's reflective of the Labour movement. I'd be surprised if, you know, possibly should be in tops then.
Yeah.
That's another issue.
But I mean, I just think that...
Yeah, the question...
Is it
yeah.
racism?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, very much so. Thank you. Right.
Panelists, please.
Can you hear me, or do I need to put this mic closer?
Use the mic. Is that better?
Yeah.
So, on the first point about creating safe spaces, that is so important. Self-care is really, really important for black women, black activists in general, because, you know, we bear the brunt of racism every day, firsthand. But we also end up dealing with so many cases. As a union rep, I'm dealing with personal cases all the time. I have people contacting me all day, every day, about every kind of issue or concern that they're experiencing. And right now, for the last, for several years, even though it's come out into the public domain now, we have the Windrush scandal with so many cases. But this isn't something new. You know, it's in the public domain, and it kind of links with the last question, is there an opportunity to talk about race? Well, actually, when the Immigration Act was being introduced, I co-founded an organisation called Movement Against Xenophobia, which was set up with the specific purpose of opposing the immigration bill, as it was then. When we said, this is going to have these effects, it's going to create an apartheid-like state, it's going to block migrants in the country, it's going to impact on immigration status of people here. Not very many people listened. When that went through Parliament, you could count on not even up to two hands how many Labour MPs voted against it. And three of them were Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell and Diane Abbott. Yeah? And this is a Labour party voted for an apartheid-like state in the UK. Now, you know, yes, Labour are saying we need to oppose this, this is outrageous, we need to oppose the Tories, but what happens? You know, we can't let that kind of error happen again, and people need to hold up their hands and say we were wrong to vote this through. You know, the injustice that people are facing is horrendous. If I have people, not just in the UK, threatened with deportation, people were deported years ago, calling me saying, I've got nowhere to sleep tonight, I haven't got a meal, can you help me? I'm having to contact a charity in Jamaica to put a roof over their head that night. So, and I also, for the last 5 years, have been coordinating bi-monthly aid convoys to refugees in France. So actually, the traumas, experiencing the traumas that everybody is going through, that you're working with and supporting and advising, we should underestimate the impact that has on you mentally of having to bear all of that on you every day, dealing with those stories and concerns. And actually, it's a lot of pressure, because if somebody's saying, you're my only person, you know, you're my point of contact to help me deal with this, it's like a huge responsibility on your shoulders to say, what if something happens to that individual? So we really do need to practice self-care, We really do need to have those safe spaces. And in terms of the advice, just do it. Do what works for the women. If it is knitting, if it's going for a walk in the park, if it's about mother and baby group, if it's just sitting around having a cup of tea, if it's a combination of those things, make it intergenerational as well. That's really important because we can all learn from our own journeys and stories, and it doesn't matter whether we're older and have more experience or younger or have less experience. Actually, are the paths we've taken, we can learn from each other. We're never too old to learn. Just because we've been around longer doesn't mean to say we know more than young people who are coming up. You may have fresh ideas, different perspectives, have gained some different strengths to deal with things. And in terms of this audience, the final question that was asked about the audience that's here, yes, it is demonstrative of the makeup of the Labour Party, the left, but actually, I'm glad there's a lot of white people here, because otherwise we'd be preaching to the converted, would we not? Actually, it's white people that do need to listen to our stories, and it's more disappointing. We have, you know, a black members fringe meeting, a TUC Congress or something, that only black people come because we talk to each other every day. We work with each other every day. We campaign on these issues every day. Actually, we do need the people that aren't thinking of these things to come along and join us and show that practical solidarity I'm talking about. But what I would say to the audience here is, don't go away and say, well, that was a very interesting session. Please go away and do something about the things we've talked about and think about what we've said and take some things forward and help these sisters we've heard come up here to progress the things they want to progress.
Okay, so sharing what people should share power.
Yeah, just in terms of the Goddesses Project, I was speaking at Black Flowers yesterday. And that was an excellent, it's only a 3-minute film. If you get an opportunity to view it, please view it because it sums everything up. And the Black Flowers Project is, we talk about safe spaces for black women. We will not have any safe spaces for black women until we reclaim our spaces in general. So the Black Flowers Project is about black women taking ownership of white spaces. And so the filming that was taking place was done in the town hall in Liverpool. And when Kiara first approached me about it, I was just like, yeah, this is great, come in. She tried to get in there, and it was like, what do you want to film? Why are you filming it? How many people are you? How are we going to be? And stuff. Anyway, they got through the door, and they started filming their film. And for me, it was an eye-opener, because we visualise what a space will look like with black people, black women in it. But until you actually see that, so I asked her, would she do me the favour of taking a photograph of our young black women sitting in the chamber in various seats. And, you know, it was so moving. When I saw it on the screen yesterday, it was just so moving, because that's what all of our political establishment should look like. We live in communities that are so diverse in terms of our sisters. We need to be there, we need to be at the forefront, we need to be representing, everybody needs to be represented. And for me, that gave us a short insight into what we should look like politically. So I would encourage you to reclaim the spaces, make white spaces our spaces. Go in there, you know, you have just as much right, or we have just as much right as anybody to use these spaces. And until we tackle that issue about what is deemed to be a white space, what is deemed to be a black space, we can't have a safe space until we tackle that issue. So on that one. Racism, in terms of racism on the agenda, yeah, you're right, in terms of racism on the agenda. Keep it on the agenda. We have a window of opportunity, I believe. We have a very small window of opportunity to have this discussion and this debate. You know, partly brought about from a groundswell of people who've become involved in politics, the grassroots up, partly in part of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, who was enabled that conversation to take place and created a void where that conversation could take place. Now is the crucial time, and as Lisa said, we often amongst each other laugh and say, well, we're preaching to the converted. We don't need to change black women's perspectives. We know what a black woman's perspective is. We need to change the people who are holding the power in the halls of, and the corridors of power. We need to change their perception. So whilst we've got this moment in time, and it will be a very small moment in time, let's have the conversation about racism in its entirety. You know, not, let's not dress it up as something that is done to us, but it doesn't have any long-term impact. Because let's remember that when we look at racism, the amount of mental health issues that come from racism, people's self-belief, their confidence levels, everything is impacted when people are subjected to racism. And we have to have that conversation, and we have to open that up. And we have to, more importantly, not just have the conversation, but we have to take action. And to come back to you, please, just very briefly, I understand what you're saying about your experience with the Women's Hospital. I just need to answer this one quite quickly. In my role as a mayoral lead for equality, I just add that in all the years that we've had a black community, this is the first time the party has had a position such as the mayoral lead for equality and race equality. So that tells you something. But going back to the point you made, Teresa, the work that I'm doing now is looking at policy, looking at procurement, looking at how many black people are employed in the city, at what positions, you know, are they in senior management, are they in middle management, what are we doing around black businesses? They're all the questions that need to be answered, because we can have conversations about racism, the moral conduct, you know, until the cows come home. But I'm a firm believer that if we don't have economic equality, we will never have equality.
So on the issue of race on the agenda, race is talked about quite a lot in the media, various forms of the media. But what is often missing from those debates is a black person talking about black experience of racism. And this is absolutely shocking. You have a handful of favoured people who get wheeled in and wheeled out day in, day out to have the same discussion and the same debate. I recently had the great displeasure of going to a discussion about racism, and there was no black person on the panel. All the examples of brutalisation, of exclusion, of deaths in custody, of mental, all of those examples, with one exception, were of black people. So how do we get to a position where we're discussing race, we're using case studies that involve a particular section of the population, and yet they are absent from the discussion? And this is shocking. The media does it day in, day out. Absolutely means that they are discussing things about us without us. The other thing is to raise a spectre of what does it mean? Why are we so concerned about race and racism? Is it that it may affect you? Is it that it's the theory of race and racism? Or is it really about how racism impacts the life chances of people, their day in, day out? So to that, I raise two questions. Why is it that so many anti-racist groups are concerned with Tommy Robinson and facing off with the likes of the EDL or whoever it might be, Britain First, and they're less concerned about institutionalised racism? Why is that? I really don't get it. And the second thing is, at what point do we stop having discussions about what might happen to people and deal with what is happening every single day? When do we have policies that enforce the laws that we do have? When do we look at who's been excluded from school and why? When do we look at who's dying in police custody? When do we look at the lack of representation at higher levels of management? When do we look at those things and address what is actually happening, as opposed to the constancy of theoretical discussions about what word was used? I'm less concerned about what you call me. I'm more concerned with how you treat me. Yes. Absolutely. in relation to your group, it sounds absolutely wonderful, particularly like this called Goddess, because I think that's fabulous. I would just say get your policies right. So many groups start and they don't have the firm foundations that they need to have. Get your policies right, figure out not just how you're going to get funding, because you will need funding, but how you're going to income generate. You have to to exist and be sustainable and to build the kind of infrastructure that you want to build. You need to think about how are we going to sustain the group beyond pots of funding, which is very difficult to access anyway. It's so competitive, it's very demoralising. So I would say think about those things, but your group sounds really wonderful and it would be love to come and visit you and see how you're getting on, because we have a similar group in Derby as well, so it would be lovely, do invite me to come along and visit you. And I think we need more groups like that. We need those spaces. And I don't think, particularly where communities are, where you have low visibility, you don't necessarily know how to reach people, think about how you're going to get people who don't know about your group to join in as well, and that the group's there for the long term. But well done, and bravo.
I don't know how it's going to find, but can I just put another hashtag out, please? I'm less concerned with what you call me, I'm more concerned with how you treat me. Okay? Thank you. Do we have time for a few more questions, or how are we doing? How are we doing? At the back. Quickly, can you come up, please? A couple more, and then we must...
Hi, my name is Julia. Mine's less of a question and more of a thank you to all of you women up there, because I am a black woman who has absolutely been under attack for I don't know God knows how long. And I think it's important that we don't just question these women, but we give them the credit that is due, because I've known to three of them. They've all reached out to me, they've all been helping me. And so it really isn't a question, it's just more of a thank you, because honestly, even last week I had some issue with work and being told to be quiet and all that rubbish. And frequently I do feel like I'm out, and frequently I say I've had enough.
You must.
I know. And I don't want to get done. At the back of you were talking at the table about some of the things you were saying. So, I'm not going to cry. This is just raw bullshit in terms of what it means to have a support network. Thank you. Hello, Tamara.
Hi. I was so desperate to come here today to this meeting. I've scraped my knee, I've power walked over here. I was at the conference centre and I just thought, I need to come and see this, because I need that inspiration that you guys emanate. It's so important for me. And just to tell you a little bit about my journey, I'm a housing solicitor, and I'm from the north, I'm from Huddersfield. And one of the reasons why I became a solicitor was because I didn't see anybody who looked like me. Of course there are solicitors in the north, in Leeds, Huddersfield, but they weren't visible. And I thought it was important for black people to come forward and take on those roles. And the type of work that I do is I represent ordinary people, people who are at risk of homelessness. You know, my background's in criminal law, that's where I started out. I really enjoyed that. Sadly, there wasn't much money in that. But I'm also a counsellor, and I'm the first and only black counsellor on Kirklees. So for me, that's important. So as you can imagine, that comes with its challenges. It comes with its challenges and its concerns. And I always, for some reason, seem to find myself in a position where I'm the only, and I'm fed up with being the only. When I was at infant school, I was the only in my year. High school, there was a lot more black people. In my job, I was the only. I saw a couple coming through, but it's really sad. So for me, I needed to be here because I need that inspiration from you guys to keep me fueled up and to keep me going. Because I'm the only and first black counsellor in Huddersfield, it means that the black community really are disassociated from politics. They don't understand politics, they don't think it relates to them, you know, they don't see the benefit of it. And for me, it's very difficult to get out there into the community. And as the doctor said there, there isn't really a black community. We've been so disseminated over the years. There's a lot of things. Austerity, funding, your lack of culture. There's so many reasons behind it. And I'm trying to bring the community together, and I'm trying to show them the importance of politics and the importance of working together as a team to achieve positive things. So it's really, really difficult. But what I want to hear from you guys is, what advice will you give me to help me improve the situation in my hometown? Because I'm constantly going along to community meetings and asking people to become councillors. Come and join me. It's very lonely up here. I need people to get more involved. And we do have a wealth of intellectual, you know, strong leaders in Kirklees. These people have been around during like the riots and so on. And I want them to come forward and support me so that I can support them. So what advice would you give me? Thank you. That's it.
I am Malcolm. I'm out from London. This is the Riverside constituency, which in 2001 and 2005 had the lowest turnout in the country. In fact, in 2001 it was 34%, which is like two-thirds of people not bothering. I think that there is a lot of urban areas where disengagement is very, very serious. I think part of the problem here is, I think probably the MP here is not particularly engaged with the community generally, I don't think. My thing is that I think possibly at such time as Louise retires or gets deselected or something like that, maybe one of the panelists might think of taking her place, perhaps.
Sisters, form a little group, whether it's through your trade union, your CLP, your ward, your local community, your family, just do something and talk. Because when you hold it all in, it's a million times worse. At least if you have a safe space where you can talk out, you can start to build solutions from there. But it's important to get it out. In terms of the point that's just been made, about voter apathy, if you want to call it that. Actually, when we founded Barrack, we didn't get bogged down with bureaucracy of elections and this, that, and the other, and structures and constitutions. What we said is, if you're a group of black people in a city or a town, organise yourself. You use Barrack, Barrack UK as a structure. We will come out and support you and back you up and help you build what you need to build. You run your own barrack in your own town or city, but you need to organise meetings. You can't just say, we're forming barrack, come to a meeting. What you need to do is organise a meeting around the issues that concern people in the town or city. And I actually think that politicians need to work more closely with grassroots campaigners and grassroots community activists and the communities. So when you're building something and you're organising a campaign around something, work with other people. It's no good telling people to come to a political meeting or to come to this meeting or to travel here. Some people are struggling to make ends meet, have to do two or three jobs and can't even pay the rent. So you need to organise around the issues that are impacting. That kind of touches on the question in the middle. When it does, it answers that as well, I think. But you just need to organise around the issues that impact on people. Start having conversations, small conversations.
and build it up from there. Speak to people that are like-minded. And actually, our struggles are connected, and sometimes we don't connect the dots. So there are things that we can bring together. Anti-austerity and anti-racism go together. Climate change and refugees go together. But a lot of the time, people are separating these things out. So we need to look at where there are commonalities, where we can bring our struggles together. The issues that working class people face, white working class people, are connected to the issues that black people are facing in terms of discrimination.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you very much.
From Amanda, what I would say in terms of what do we do in terms of communities, I mean, I cut my teeth in community politics before I went into mainstream politics, and I, maybe not all elected members might agree, but I would say build your power base in your community. I spend more time in my community than I do in going to select committee meetings and council meetings. That for me is one of the areas where I think my time is worst utilised. My time is utilised to its best ability within my community. And I never, ever decry what community does in terms of organising. But we have a difficult issue here, and we can't just sort of skate over this. It is about our communities and how they engage politically. And one of the problems is that we don't see people who look like us within politics, and we have to challenge that. So if we had more people who look like us, we'd get more people more inclined to get involved. One thing that I'd say, that in terms of a vote, when I go up for election, I've increased my vote up to 89%. I took that seat off a Lib Dem 13 years ago. Now, I know my community will come out and vote. They may not necessarily get involved in the party, but they get involved in every other strand of life within our community. So work with your power base, ensure that you keep your community on side. More importantly, make sure you listen to grassroots community. Because I think there's some confusion here among some elected members, but the way I like to see it, it's a dual carriageway, it's not a one-way street. We're here to represent our communities, and we have to listen in order to do that.
Congratulations on your election. Okay, so in terms of how you get more people involved, this is what I would do. I wouldn't necessarily ask them to get to the stage where you're at. I'd ask them to do small things, to contribute in small ways, and slowly build that engagement. And the more people you ask to do small things to contribute to politics, community politics, the more engaged they become. Some won't, obviously some will fall away, but you might find that of 10 people, 3 remain engaged. That's one tactic that I would use. But I know it's not easy, so it's much more difficult when you're actually there at the full face. With regard to apathy and voting, it's a really difficult one, because on what basis? A lot of people have no grounding in how they should vote, why they should vote. They have no understanding that the vote is just one step in a journey of political engagement. And so some people do vote and they expect sea change. That's not going to happen. But this political education is not happening anywhere. I know that John McDonald's, which I didn't go to, one of the keynotes at the beginning was to talk about political education. I noticed there's a strand of that running through this World Transformed series of events. But it's been lacking. People aren't aware. People have lost track. That talk of a working class is something of a misnomer, because people don't necessarily associate with the working class. On what basis is the working class in the 21st century? What are the parameters of that? I went to, a meeting not long ago in which somebody stood up and said, and they were part of their CLP, active. What does it mean? What does it mean? Who's going to tell people, explain, explore? And there's no grassroots education. I'm not surprised that people don't vote, but when you talk to them, when you go where they are, they want to know, why should I vote for this person? On what basis? What are the policies? Policies are often also that the language isn't accessible. You know, yes, there's a manifesto, but it's not accessible or translated for ordinary people. In terms of my last comment, it's 100 years this year since women got the vote. And yet in towns like some women, that's right, some women. And in towns like mine, we have yet to have a single black woman represented on our local council. And that is pretty shocking. So come on, I know it's gonna be, we've just got to stand up, we've got to keep doing it. And also we need to pick our battles very carefully, which is I guess for your Goddess Project and also as a councillor. We sometimes pick the wrong battles, and I think this battle of political representation is one that we have to win. How we win it, multiple ideas, but yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, excellent. We put our hands together for our excellent panelists. Thank you very much.